News, it's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After weeks of combing through a state Senate casino bill, a House super committee this week advised the full House to vote no on this proposal. But that rejection was by the tightest of margins, with 23 members against and 22 in favor. So although it was a setback for gambling supporters, including Governor Hassan, casino backers took heart in how close they came to victory and set their sights on the full House vote next week. Also this week, after repeated warnings that their budget version won't be as generous as the House's, Senate finance members got specific, announcing they see a $168 million shortfall. Senators blame most of this on one item called the Medicaid Enhancement Tax, or MET. They said the House and governor had way overestimated how much MET money would come through and that Senate projections were more realistic, albeit more sobering, because they could mean major budget cuts. Meanwhile, outside the State House, there was other news this week, including controversy regarding the homeless in Concord and a band of Free Staters in Keene kicking up some dust in the name of Robin Hood. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'll catch up on the top stories of the week. Let's hear from you, too. What are some of the news items that have drawn your interest, caught your attention this week? What questions or comments do you have about some of the major stories we're going to be looking at this hour? Give us a call. We'd love to hear what you think. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests in studio with us: Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, happy Friday. Always great to see you.
Thanks. Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. And Norma, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. And Gary, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Well, and all of you, I want to turn to that big vote in the House this week on gambling. Not a full House vote, but a super committee. Makes me think about the super committees, Gary, that they have in Washington. Just remind us, who and what was this super committee all about?
Well, this super committee was put together by House Speaker Terry Norelli. It included the members of the Finance and the Ways and Means Committee, the two budget writing committees essentially in the House. And they broke up into three subcommittees, which is regulation, community impact, and revenues. And they spent the last 3.5 weeks, almost 4 weeks, going into minute detail, getting into the weeds, taking these bills, this bill apart piece by piece, trying to get all the experts that they could find. And then all of a sudden, we're going to have to bring it all back together and make a decision. And they made a decision finally this week. And it was, as you said, razor thin 23-22, which actually I think was kind of a surprise to most people, because I think most people thought it wouldn't even be that close.
Yeah, it was really close. I was surprised, having watched many gambling votes in the House. And just remind us, Gary, because it's worth being reminded of, the legislature doesn't operate like Congress. Just because a committee says yes or no doesn't mean the bill is gone. The full House always gets a say.
They always have to vote on every bill in the New Hampshire legislature. And the other part of that is about 20 years ago, I guess it was, they decided that when a bill would come up, you used to be able to come up and make any motion you wanted on it, no matter what the committee report was. But about 20, it was under Donna Sitek when she was House Speaker. They said you have to first vote on the committee recommendation. So it makes it doubly difficult for the gambling supporters now, because they're going to have to defeat the motion to kill the bill first before we can bring up any other kind of amendments to the bill.
Two votes. Wow. So you guys really have to know all this parliamentary procedure, and good for you. And Norma, as Gary said, you know, the House members of this committee really went through it in great detail, from what percentage of money the state should get to whether employees at the casino should have on-site daycare. I mean, detail, detail, detail. But in the end, what happened to all that work?
Well, there's going to be one omnibus amendment that, as Gary said, if they can persuade the House to vote down the motion to kill the bill, which I might point out doesn't necessarily mean this bill is going to survive, because as they do in Congress, you'll find people all over the place. They might say, you know what, we should have debated those amendments, and we didn't, even though the people in the committee who didn't want to debate the amendments said, look, we've spent a month on this. It was a strategic move by Mary Jane Wallner, the chair of that committee, not to go through a vote on each amendment, because you never know where you're going to end up after that with the votes. Would you have people who said, yeah, let's make this a better bill, and then I'm going to kill it? Or would you have people say, let's make it a better bill, and I was going to kill it, but now I'm not? And I think that's going to happen on the floor of the House. If they can overturn the motion, they'll have people say, okay, we have this omnibus amendment, which it makes some changes, but not dramatic changes that the other side, the Senate, wouldn't say, okay, we agree, let's just send it on to the governor. I can see that happening. Excuse me. But I can see also, if they do that, you'll have all kinds of debate by other people who, for example, Representative Dan McGuire wanted to put out anybody who has a liquor license can have, what, five or six video lotteries.
He actually didn't cap it. They could have as many.
Any as they want.
Really? So yes. We're going from a bill about one casino to amendments that say, you know, put a couple slots wherever.
If you overturn the motion to kill it, everybody gets a shot at any amendment they
want
to bring in.
It's a free-for-all. Wow. And just real quickly, Norma, you and I have talked about this 100 times probably. We've seen so many casino bills come and go. Were you surprised, Norma, by this one vote loss?
No, I guess I was initially, and then I got to thinking about it. The governor's been working it hard, and she's been lobbying, and there are a lot of freshmen in the House, and the House is now controlled by Democrats, and there are freshman Democrats who we don't know how they vote on gambling because they haven't done it. You have hardcore on each side, and then you have these unknowns. You have people who say, well, I really don't want to see the Senate cut the budget. I really think this is the only new revenue source, or people are saying, we're never going to have an income or sales tax. Gambling's the only way to go. This is the best shot we're going to have. Let's do it. And I think those are the unknowns.
Yeah, so some on the left supporting this as well. And as has been said before, this is not a partisan issue in New Hampshire.
Oh, no.
When you look at the votes, there's just as many Democrats and Republicans on either side.
And Terry Norelli, who's the House Speaker, has not made it a caucus position. So that was another reason it was kind of a free-for-all at the committee level. It was anybody can do anything they want. There certainly were some rules in terms of how the committee structured it, but I think she wanted to give it as big a showing as she could, given that it's a Democratic governor pushing for it.
Yeah. Okay. So, Dean, give us more on the politics of it.
Absolutely. You know, we saw Governor Hassan try to put the best possible face on this vote the other day. You know, the argument is that the House has traditionally not supported casino gambling, so the fact that you essentially had a split vote in the committee, for her, that's a sign that it's going to be close, but there is a possibility that the legislation will be passed. You know, the big political question for me, the sort of end run about around amendments aside in committee are we at a point now where legislators are amenable to passing casino gambling, provided you get the right alignment of amendments on the bill? So are there ways in which Governor Hassan can cut deals or tweak the legislation with the help of members of the legislature so that it's palatable to a majority of members of the House? Or are we simply at a point now where ideologically kind of both sides are dug in, people have their preferences, so that it's not really a function of just kind of tweaking the bill to get it in the right format? And so that's the big question, and that's what we don't really know.
Yeah, and that's a question I wanted to ask you about, Dean. So I'm glad you raised it. You know, at this point, what more can casino supporters or casino opponents say about this to change any hearts and minds? I mean, it just seems like, and I know I'm in the news business, so I've been watching this more closely than most, but it just feels like everything's been done and said at this
point.
It's
very difficult to know because we don't have any underlying measure of core preferences on gambling in the House. So we don't really know, you know, do people on principle, is this an issue of principle on both sides, or is it simply the case that both sides have particular tweaks that they want made to the legislation? The problem with that is it becomes, as we were, Norma, I think, was talking about, just kind of the huge number of potential amendments that we might have to deal with on the floor of the House, it becomes almost an infinite regress. You know, you tweak the bill in one way, and then some other people have an issue, and then they come back with another amendment. And so, the question really is, and I've seen this at the presidential level many times, are there still deals to be made that will make this passable, or is it simply that their core preferences are already set, and it is what it is, and we just don't know what that underlying distribution is?
Well, again, the phone number for you to join our Add a New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us. What are some of the news items that drew your interest this week, caught your attention? What questions or comments do you have about some of the major stories we're looking at, including this big vote on gambling in the House this week by the Super Committee? We're also talking a minute about some of the Senate issues and its comments on the budget this week. It had some cold water splashing on the House budget, if we could put it that way. The phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Gary, you wanted to jump back in on some of the casino comments.
Well, Dean was talking about whether you have this, people are so set in their ways. And I think what you see here is like the people who've been in the House for a number of years or at least a couple of terms, those people are still set in their ways. They haven't changed their mind. The real wild card here, if you will, is about 100 new freshman Democrats. Nobody knows where they stand, really. And that's where Governor Hassan has been focusing her attention, on those people. And those people are the ones that are going to decide whether this bill passes or it doesn't.
Well, and some of those might be favorably disposed to Governor Hassan, yeah, feeling like she helped them get
absolutely
into office. Yeah,
absolutely.
Go ahead, Norma.
Well, I think Gary's absolutely right, but Dean is also right. What if so far we have not seen a really concerted, coordinated effort here. We've seen the Millennium Gaming people lobbying hard. We've seen a little bit of lobbying for Green Meadow Golf Course, New Hampshire Speedway, but none of the outsiders have really come in yet because they want to wait and see if New Hampshire passes it. But what we really haven't seen is a really concerted effort. Certainly by the governor, there has been lobbying to get around one amendment. And if we come to the House floor on Wednesday and they have one amendment and they've got this lobbying effort and they can block the others, yeah, they might get it through and they might get it through the Senate without going to a conference committee, which is where they try to negotiate differences, which could open up, you know, a whole nother avenue of possibilities, which could lead to the defeat of the bill. So the way I see it, if ITL, which is inexpedient to legislate, they like to talk in lingo, means killing the bill. If that is overturned and they get this one omnibus amendment on and it passes, then we'll probably have gambling.
Wow. Okay. Well, lots to follow up on. And next week, we'll have a vote by the full House, so we'll be following up on that. I'm going to finish that out there. We're going to turn to some other subjects after a very short break. You can join us, though, with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477.
It's The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Good morning.
Our job at NHPR is to bring to New Hampshire the most complete stories about New Hampshire. And whether it's developing a new story or expanding the range of perspective on an ongoing story, you can help us. Join our Public Insight Network and let us know which stories we should speak with you about. Find out more about PIN at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the Clean Bedroom, Organic Mattress, and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, creating eco-friendly and healthy sleep environments. Also on the web at cleanbedroom.com. And from Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank, trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs, themerrimack.com. And from Small Dog Electronics, offering Dr. Small Dog house calls for home and business, Mac and PC technical service and repair, smalldog.com/doctor. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking at some of the top stories that Granite Staters were talking about this week. We invite you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We talked just a moment ago about the big vote on gambling in the House this week. If you'd like to chime in on that, we'd love to hear from you or your questions and comments about other news stories that really caught your ear this week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. There were a couple stories on healthcare issues this week as the state, like many others, prepares to put the Affordable Care Act into place. With that 2014 deadline coming, with us now for more on that is NHPR's Todd Bookman, who covers healthcare and health policy for us. And Todd, thanks for giving us a few minutes this morning.
Good morning, Laura.
So there was some discussion this week again of the health exchanges that are a big part of the Affordable Care Act. Just remind us, Todd, what they are, why these are so important. important.
So exchanges are these new central marketplaces where individuals will shop for insurance. It's where people can also receive the big tax subsidies that are intended to make insurance affordable to people that currently don't have it. And New Hampshire is a state, along with five others, that has opted for this partnership health exchange. And there are really two components to this. One is regulation. In entering into a partnership, the state's insurance department will continue to regulate the plans sold in the exchange. The second component, and this is where New Hampshire is hitting some stumbling blocks, is this consumer assistance portion, providing a system whereby people that don't have insurance can receive basically some help in navigating this new exchange.
Sure, and as anybody who's tried to, you know, look at their company policy, it's tricky. So there's some money in question, Todd, that would help folks out when they're trying to just sort their way through these exchanges.
Right. And this is what reform advocates have been lobbying about, and lobbying hard, especially we've seen last week and this week. The state was awarded $5.4 million in grant funds. And right now, there's $340,000 sitting in front of the Joint Fiscal Committee. This is money that's been awarded, but Joint Fiscal hasn't accepted the funds. And the reason is some Republican lawmakers weren't pleased that the insurance department went ahead and applied for this money. And so it's been awarded. The state hasn't been able to use it. The other, the larger portion, the $5 million, is actually a budget item that'll have to get passed along with the traditional budget. The money is intended to do basically three things. One is create some state-specific education materials. So this may be a website, this may be other marketing materials to get the word out about what the exchange is, how people can use it, its goals, and how you can get your subsidies. A second portion is navigators. These are what's envisioned, or you'll basically have people that can go out into the community and help people use the exchange. So help them figure out the paperwork. The exchanges are often compared to something like Travelocity or Orbitz. It's frankly going to be a lot more complicated than that to buy health insurance, but the navigators are intended to help assist people, especially people that have never bought health insurance before, people that may not be native English speakers.
So navigators are actually human beings that help you out with this.
At the end, they are human beings. Yeah. They're entities that will be awarded these grants. The Navigator program is actually a federally funded program. The state will regulate the navigators. The state will also regulate this other option. These are the in-person assisters. And this is where, you know, when you take a 2,000-page law like the Affordable Care Act, it can get so complicated. The in-person assisters are this other part of the consumer assistance portion of the partnership. They will basically, in theory, run just the way the navigators run. These are human beings that will go out into the community to help people navigate the exchange.
It reminds me of when they expanded Medicare prescription drug coverage, Medicare Part D. There was also grants and so forth for community groups to get seniors some help with figuring this out.
Right. And what I've been hearing is that there's a lot of the same expectations that this may have a very bumpy rollout in the first few months. But like Medicare Part D, give it some time and people say this system will the kinks will work itself out and we'll get as many people as possible covered. There's still 125,000 people in New Hampshire without health insurance.
So again, there's some money in the balance. Hasn't been approved. It's been approved by the feds, but the state hasn't started spending it yet for this assistance. When's it going to sort of spurt out of the pipeline, if I could put it that way, Todd, if at all?
The vote will come June 7th. That's when it's slated for, likely slated for in Joint Fiscal. That's the $340,000 portion. That money's got to move through quickly. Then the $5 million will be rolled out in the budget process. So that we may not see for some time also.
And Todd, just real broadly, do you have any other sort of thoughts or comments on where New Hampshire is at in terms of getting the structure in place for the Affordable Care Act, other parts that are moving into place or not moving into place as New Hampshire and every state approaches this 2014 deadline? It's not that far away. We're almost halfway through the year.
It's not, and the exchanges are going to be up and running October 1st. Remember, because we're doing this partnership, there are major tasks that are actually going to be handled by the federal government. The government is setting up the website. The federal government, I should say, is setting up the call center, the 1-800 call center. They're going to take care of most of the marketing. The state still needs to sort out these other details, the in-person assisters, the regulation of the navigators, some state-specific marketing efforts. But by and large, it's the federal government that's tasked with the major pieces of the exchange. The other big part of the Affordable Care Act that New Hampshire hasn't quite tackled yet is Medicaid expansion. And this is something that we'll see through the budgeting process. Governor Hassan supports it. The House-approved budget lays out the funding for Medicaid expansion. Remember, when the Supreme Court ruled on the Affordable Care Act, it said states must have a choice.
Right.
And so that choice is still before New Hampshire lawmakers. Senate budget writers have taken a much more skeptical approach to Medicaid expansion. It has an $85 million price tag through 2020. It would cover roughly 60,000 people. But there's what Republicans, some top Republicans have said, is that there's no guarantees that that there's going to be money after the year 2020. And this may just not be financially tenable for the state.
All right, Todd, thank you very much. Important stuff. And I have the feeling that as this gets closer to the deadline, we'll be talking about this again. Thank you.
I think so. Thanks.
All right. That's Todd Bookman. Again, he covers health care and health policy for us here at NHPR. The phone number for you to join us in our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You can also post your thoughts and comments on the top news stories of the week on our Facebook page. And Dean Spiliotis, I do want to move into what Todd mentioned, the Senate and its take on the budget this week. But I'm interested, too, there's been some action on the Affordable Care Act at the national level as well.
That's right. I mean, the larger context here is that even though the Supreme Court has now ruled on Obamacare, Republicans and particularly conservatives are still working very hard to undercut the legislation. So we have the House of Representatives and Congress now for the 37th time holding a vote to repeal Obamacare. And I think the concern with the health exchanges locally is among conservatives is that when that initial $5 million grant is gone, the state is essentially left with an unfunded mandate. So kind of the larger context here is, in addition to kind of the electoral aspect of 2014, is that you roll out Obamacare. It creates a number of new mandates for services where the immediate interaction is between the state and localities and citizens rather than the federal government. And then once this initial round of grants dries up or the legislation changes or something like that, the states are left holding the bag. So, this is going to continue to be a big electoral issue. I mean, I've talked to some conservatives who hope that this rollout is actually a bit of a mess because they'll say, I told you so. And we're going to be hearing about it in November of 2014. So even though it's now been ruled on by the Supreme Court, it's moving forward. Conservatives are still very actively working to if not repeal it, at least modify it in ways they find palatable.
Well, and it's interesting to hear Todd talk about how it's playing into the budget process, which is now in the state Senate, as you all know. And I wonder, Gary Reno, to you first, how is Medicaid expansion being talked about as senators look at the state budget? Todd touched on it, but I'd love to hear from you, too, since you're tracking the legislature.
Well, there's a certain amount of money that has to be in the budget this year and this upcoming budget to pay for the program, mostly administrative costs, because the federal government during the first 7 years picks up 100% of the medical costs. So it's been going back and forth. The House obviously decided that they wanted to participate in it. The Senate is being much more reluctant, and they're meeting this afternoon actually to talk about some of that.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. All right.
And not really making any decisions until next week or the week after.
Norma?
Well, I think that what they're meeting about this afternoon, again, is to go over what is this going to cost us. Yeah. And I think they're pushing in the Senate hard, and I think the state in general, to expand Medicaid if it's managed care Medicaid, but not if it's not managed care, because the Health and Human Services Department thinks it's not practical to do it otherwise. But I know we've talked on the show before, you need to have the hospitals and mental health centers on board with networks for that to work, and they aren't yet. And we have this triangle, as we've talked before, and we're going to talk about the Medicaid enhancement tax, where hospitals say the rates you're paying us are too low. And recently the department rejiggered the rates, not the bottom line, but how these managed care operators could negotiate to try and get the hospitals to sign on. So there's a lot of balls in the air right now, and just expanding Medicaid is a small piece.
Right, and I definitely want to ask about the conflict with the hospitals, how that's affecting the Affordable Care Act, also the budget. Let me also invite our listeners, though, to join us as well, 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we want your thoughts on some of the top stories this week, whether it's the House action on casino gambling that we talked about earlier, that super close vote by the super committee. Also, we've been talking about the movement toward the Affordable Care Act in New Hampshire. It's sticky, as we're hearing. If you want you to ask about that or give some comments and thoughts, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And a couple emails, folks, that are coming in. Here's one from Marty in Dalton, who says, the one thing that most can agree on is that New Hampshire needs new ongoing revenue. There is a real possibility of new revenue from Hydro-Québec by leasing state rights-of-way for transmission of high-voltage electricity to southern New England. I know that Hydro-Québec and NSTAR want to use PSNH rights-of-way to keep all their profits in-house and claim they couldn't afford to complete the Northern Pass if they were required to bury the lines. However, other states require new transmission lines to be buried in their projects going forward. Marty says, I think our legislators should be looking out for what's best for New Hampshire. Now, this gets us into the Northern Pass, which is sort of an ongoing story. And Marty, I really appreciate you jumping in. As I understand all of you, this is, speaking of things being sticky, this is kind of sticky now too, right? I mean, they're supposed to have, right now, Norma.
The efforts this year to put a moratorium on those kinds of projects got pushed off. And instead, they're looking at how can we shore up or beef up our site evaluation committee? Because even if a public service company got through or Northern Pass got through the initial phase of this project, this committee would have to say, yeah, you know, we think you should bury the lines from here to here or do this to that. But it's not clear what the visual impact, how that would play a role in their criteria. So there's a lot of work and consideration in that, what we should study, but it's not stopping anything. And so far, Northern Pass has not announced a route. They keep putting it off. And
until it's supposed to be in January, now it's July.
And until they announce a route, I think there's going to still be all this swirling around and no resolution.
Well, Marty, I appreciate the comment. And next week, I want to let you and everybody else know that we're going to do a program on this broader idea of New Hampshire needs a new energy plan with all these projects on the table. You know, many people are saying, look, we need to look at the big picture here. So maybe a little bit more on that next week, Marty. Thanks for the email. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And I want to return to the State House for another moment. And Gary, to you, the Senate this week had tough words for House budget writers. And while members have been warning for a while that their budget can't be as generous as the House's, they got pretty specific this week. What did they say, Gary?
Well, they said basically that you're about $168 million short of being balanced.
That was kind of a wow moment, wasn't it?
Well, a little while ago it was $300 million, so it's coming down a little bit.
It's a moving target.
Most of that money is from the Medicaid Enhancement Tax, which is the tax on net patient receipts that hospitals pay, or sometimes known as Mediscam in the old days. And the House basically adopted the same thing that the governor has Hassan proposed, which is you pay what we think you owe hospitals, and we'll give you some of that money back along with the federal match.
And it worked for 20 years,
and
didn't it?
It worked for 20 years.
Got started under Judd Gregg.
But the hospitals, when they stopped paying the largest hospitals in the state, the uncompensated care reimbursement, as they call it, the hospitals said, well, we used to just give you this money because we always got it back. Now we're going to go, like if you're Dartmouth Hitchcock, all these people that we treat from Vermont, we're not going to pay the tax on them. And various other things like that that went on. So they've been paying a lot less tax than the state thinks they ought to be paying. And so Governor Hassan basically said, you pay what we think you ought to pay, and we'll get you more money. And this is the issue here. And the Senate is saying that they're not going to pay us any more money, even though they would get more money back.
They're saying, be realistic,
Governor. Be realistic,
Governor.
Here.
Yeah.
And that accounts for $100 million more.
Yeah. And that's a lot.
That's a lot of it.
It's a matter of interpretation, it seems like, Norma.
Well, it's a matter of interpreting what are my net patient revenues, as Gary said. But as he also said, that's I think it's $107 million of the difference. They're only $62 million apart in revenue. That's not a lot, especially if you consider that the Senate isn't accepting $40 million in higher cigarette tax revenue that the House cannot. Now you've really narrowed it down. They're not accepting $26 million in revenue that the House said that they would get by beefing up auditing functions at the Department of Revenue Administration. They're not accepting, I think it's $13 million in revenue from delaying implementing some tax breaks for business that the last legislature delayed to this legislature. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at the assumptions. Each side has their own assumptions on how they want to balance the budget. The Senate said they're not going to take taxes, raise taxes. The House has raised very few, I mean the cigarette tax and the gas tax. But if you don't look at it in whole, you can't just say, wow, you're $168 million out of balance. You're $168 million out of balance because I say my assumptions are right and yours are wrong.
Well, and I was reading through it and I was thinking, you know, how is the average person supposed to figure out who's right? I mean, everybody makes their assumptions and everybody's basing those assumptions on something.
Well, at this point, everyone's positioning. It's May. Next month, we're going to go into a conference on the budget. And each side is positioning itself as to what its priorities are. When you look at it overall, they have very similar priorities. They both support expanding services for the mentally ill. They both support expanding services for the disabled. They both support a lot of the same programs that were cut last time.
Infrastructure, university
Correct.
System.
But they have different methods of paying. The Senate wants to pay, and not in this particular, I imagine very little, but not this session, because if we did approve gambling, the revenues beyond the licensing fee wouldn't start flowing for several years. They want to use that money for higher ed, for highway improvements, for development in the North Country. So if you look at the mix, and they'll get together in next month and they'll hash it out, and nobody will be perfectly happy because they never are.
It's always a party in June at the State House when that budget deadline comes every 2 years. Dean Spiliotis, love your thoughts here.
Yeah, I mean, Norma's right. It really does stem from the assumptions you make about revenues, but those assumptions are a function of kind of your policy choices going in. So, you know, Republicans in the Senate have said all along, we're not going to have a gas tax, we're not going to raise a cigarette tax. That's kind of the underlying basis from which they then have assumptions about revenue. And then the other issue, as Gary mentioned, is that this disagreement about estimates in the medical the MET of $107 or $108 million, that comes with another $107, $108 million in federal matching funds. So you're actually talking about a loss of about $214 million. So it's a pretty significant
Over 2 years,
chunk of change.
It adds up. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and yeah, Democrats said – oh, go ahead, Norma. Yeah.
But Dean, as Bob O'Dell, who's the Ways and Means Chairman in the Senate, points out, we never had that money. I mean, we're at about $180 million in receipts. And that's what we've had. So the House and the governor upped the estimate by that $100 million. It's not like we're losing money we never had.
But to the extent that it's all calculations based on assumptions and projections,
Correct.
That still goes into the mix. And, you know, my sense is that, you know, the nature of the assumptions are really drive what you can think about in terms of policy choices.
Well, we are going to go to the city of Keene after a short break and hear what the Free Staters are up to over there. We'll also take your calls and emails, so stay with us.
It's 9:39. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, and from LaValle and Middleton Building Supply, offering pure performance from Pittsburgh paints, combining the latest environmental attributes with premium performance. LaValle's.com. And from the Shaheen and Gordon Law Firm, business and corporate law, health care, family matters, criminal defense, and personal injury, offices in Dover, Concord, and Manchester. ShaheenGordon.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock, it's the Diane Rehm Show on New Hampshire Public Radio.
One more spin. Come on. It's party. There you go.
If a casino were to open in your town, what would it mean for you, your community, or businesses nearby? As state lawmakers consider casino legislation, NHPR reporters bring you face-to-face with Millennium Gaming, one of the companies in the running to build a casino. We visit their casino in Pennsylvania and find out what folks in Salem think about the possibility of a casino moving into their town. NHPR's gambling series begins next week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, yet another revamp for public education here in New Hampshire and across the nation. It's called The Common Core. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join our roundtable as we catch up on some of the top news stories of this week that Granite Staters were talking about. We've talked a lot about the House and Senate tussle over the budget. We've looked at the Affordable Care Act and the rollout to its implementation here in New Hampshire. We've also been looking at the House activity on casino gambling. That's been a big issue with the Super Committee vote this week. We'd love your thoughts on these and other stories. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And I wanted to ask you, Dean Spiliotis, very quickly about a story that's made headlines, especially in Concord, but also in Manchester. And Dean, that's how to deal with the homeless. The city of Concord passed a law this week forbidding panhandling, not everywhere, but along roads and intersections. And then the state and the city have been evicting homeless people living in tent camps on state land and private property. What's the sentiment driving this here, Dean? It's become more of a city story and moved on to the state level as well, since a lot of this land is state-owned.
Yeah, and a very significant story for anybody who lives in Concord, who spends a significant amount of time here. That's right. The city council unanimously passed this resolution piece of legislation on panhandling that actually managed to not use the words panhandling or solicitation. This has been a very kind of delicate dance between supporters, people who work with the homeless, and people who have issues with what is perceived as an increase in aggressive panhandling in the city, particularly along the roadside at the intersection of Loudoun Road and the exit 14 in the city.
And where
where the grocery stores are. This was actually their third attempt at the doing this. The first ordinance said it would be that aggressive panhandling, and it mentioned it by name, would be a misdemeanor subject to 90 days in jail. They then scaled that back a second time, and finally on the third iteration, they came up with this idea of if there's an exchange of anything between someone in a car and someone standing on the side of the road, they're not going to call it panhandling, but the person standing on the side of the road is subject to a $500 fine. So
not the person who gives
person
him
in
or
the
her
car
the five
cannot
do-
be helped.
The
it's the person standing on the side of the road. The concern was a First Amendment that people should be able to stand on the side of the road with a sign if they want. The issue is the hazard created by an exchange between driver and pedestrian. The other issue you mentioned is the New Hampshire ACLU is helping three homeless men who were evicted from public grounds at that same exit near the Everett Arena, right at exit 14, a place where a lot of homeless tend to camp. And they are suing, arguing that the ordinance that prohibits camping on public grounds says that you can, in some instances, have permission to do that. So they are arguing that these men should have been granted a hearing to ask for permission, and that is now going to happen on May 20th. The other issue was that the Department of Transportation, which has controls this particular issue, doesn't actually control the land; it only controls the roads. So these are sort of two big kind of flashpoints in what has been an ongoing issue for Concord, and it really has been this sort of delicate dance between the city council, homeless activists, and various individuals who have complained about this panhandling. But there have been a lot of very sort of moving stories in the newspapers, et cetera.
Yeah, and Gary Reno, your newspaper this week, although this wasn't your story, but your paper reported this morning that Manchester city officials have told a church group that it can't serve breakfast to homeless people in Veterans Park. Mm-hmm. So that was also, it's not just Concord dealing with this.
No, it's very much in Manchester, too. Several years ago, a lot of homeless people were gathering in another park in the city, and they made a point of clearing them out, and that was a big controversy. And the idea here is, you don't want to the city fathers really say this is bringing the homeless people here, and once they're there, they stay there all day, and then people don't get to use the park, and it's all, it's a complicated issue, a very complicated issue.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks for that update. And I want to go now to the city of Keene. We're joined on the phone by Jacqueline Polachko. She's a city reporter for the Keene Sentinel, and she's going to update us on what's been happening in Keene with the Free State Movement. Lots of activists there in Keene. And Jacqueline, thanks a lot for your time. We really appreciate it.
Oh, nice to talk to you.
So some activity in Keene in the name of Robin Hood and his Merry Men. What's happening there?
Yeah, well, starting back in December, a group calling themselves the Robin Hooders have gone around to parking meters and have put in some coins whenever they see a parking meter that's about to expire, so drivers will not get a parking ticket. The fine here in Keene is $5 for a parking ticket. And starting in around mid-March, the city of Keene started an investigation. They hired a former Keene police captain for about $1,300 to do an investigation to see if these Robin Hooders were harassing any parking enforcement officers, because parking enforcement officers did have some concerns that Robin Hooders were too close to them, not allowing them to do their jobs, and kind of stressing them out a little bit. So the city officials did determine that there was some harassing behavior going on, and they filed a petition in Cheshire County Superior Court earlier this month asking the court to grant a 50-foot safety zone around the officers so the Robin Hooders would not be able to do harassing behavior.
Wow. So, Jacqueline, it wasn't so much you can't, you know, pay it forward, you can't put coins in somebody's meter. It's more that when you do encounter a traffic enforcement person, what we used to call a meter maid, you can't harass that person. You can't give them a hard time.
Yeah, that's correct. And I know I spoke to city manager John McLean yesterday, and he said the city has no problem with Robin Hooders expressing themselves, going around putting coins in meters. But they do have a problem when the safety of parking enforcement officers is in danger. Some of these parking enforcement officers have talked about how they have been taunted, interfered with, intimidated, and they have said that they've gone home and they have had panic attacks, and they've been extremely stressed out to the point where they have a red face, and they feel like they can't even take bathroom or lunch breaks because the Robin Hooders will be waiting for them to follow them around as they do their job.
Wow, and I think I read also that city officials were concerned, A, these folks would quit, and B, they'd have a hard time finding new people to take those jobs.
Yeah, that's correct. It is a time-consuming and money-intensive prospect, too. You know, if we have three parking enforcement officers right now, and if they did quit, that does leave the city of Keene in a bit of a problem.
Well, Jacqueline, I want to ask about the reaction among your readers and the citizens of Keene to this. But before I do, I want to share an email from Kimberly with you. She's got her own reaction. She says, media coverage of the parking enforcement harassment case in Keene has fallen quite short. The local community is well aware that the Robin Hooders, in quotes, in our town are not friendly do-gooders. They are a rogue group of rogue freestaters affiliated with a group called Free Keene that, among a host of other behaviors, have been treating the parking enforcement officers poorly for some time now. Please do not mistake their actions as altruistic. They are a cult that prey upon youth and vulnerable populations in order to promote civil unrest. So that's the reaction from Kimberly. What other reactions have you gotten in Keene?
I think that's a pretty fair reaction from a lot of readers that we have. It is worth pointing out that the Robin Hooders, some of them are associated with the Free Keene group, and the Free Keene group in the past has ruffled some feathers here. They like to protest what they call victimless crimes. So, for example, they have smoked marijuana downtown. Last year they went to a Keene City Council meeting playing a drinking game to protest open container laws. So, you know, they do, like I said, like to ruffle some feathers around here. And one of the reasons why they did start this Robin Hood project was because they don't agree with the parking enforcement operation. So I have heard from readers who say, you know, if they're trying to do a good thing, why do they have to brag about it and make a big deal about it? And some other readers have agreed with the city that they think the Robin Hooders are harassing the parking enforcement officers.
And real quickly, Jacqueline, as I understand, you got Robin Hooded.
I did, yeah.
They filled your meter.
They did. We have to park downtown, so a lot of the reporters here and people who work in the office, we have benefited from receiving some coins in the meter. And you know, it is a nice thing, but it's also, it does kind of, it's not exactly fair to the parking enforcement officers. If you're going to do a nice thing, do a nice thing. But when someone's being harassed, it's not the best way to go about it.
And Jacqueline, Norma Love from the Associated Press wants to ask you something real quick.
I was wondering if they chalk your tires if you park too long in a section, if they, you know, if they go around and rub the chalk off.
That's an idea.
They actually have done that, too.
Okay. All right. Jacqueline, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Jacqueline Palachko, again, city reporter for the Keene Sentinel, updating us on what's been going on with the Free State movement in that city. And I actually have another email on this. Dean Spiliotis, I want to throw this to you. This is from Christopher in Manchester. He says, the Free State project seems to be fading in New Hampshire. This is Christopher talking. He says, do you think the unfolding IRS scandal will give these folks new momentum and, in a sense, resurrect the movement? It's a good question. I like that he's connecting sort of what's happening here locally with what's happening nationally.
Yeah, and that is interesting, although the free staters we typically think of as being kind of sort of grassroots activists at the very local level. So there may be some kind of tie-in ideologically in terms of opposition to the IRS. But you know, the interesting thing for me is just listening to the discussion a moment ago, sort of how murky this can become, because one person's grassroots activism is really another person's harassment. So
That's been kind of an issue.
Yeah, and there's always a sort of balance between free speech rights and the you know, the right of people to basically be essentially not be harassed. You know, I don't know that it's so much that we've talked about this before. I don't know that it's so much that the Free State movement is fading. You know, for listeners, this is the sort of libertarian group that wanted to bring 20,000 individuals here over 10 years. They've only succeeded in bringing a couple thousand, I think. But Free Statism has become kind of an ideological position in the state that is sort of applied to a lot of different and diverse sorts of activity. So it's not even clear that there is kind of, you know, you talk about, the reporter mentioned kind of rogue free staters. So, you know, there are free staters. Are these people rogues because they're free staters, or are they a rogue group of free staters? I wasn't quite sure. So, you know, I think they're going to continue to be active. They work at the real grassroots level, boards of education, city councils, you know, town organizations. As I've said before, I think it's the idea of kind of free statism has been now sort of woven into our political narrative in the state.
It's been a decade.
It's been a while. But in terms of the actual activism and kind of involvement at the electoral level and representative level, not quite where they wanted it to be.
Well, and Christopher brought up national news, and I did want to talk a little bit about national politics with the three of you. And I'll start with you again, Dean, but definitely want to hear from you too, Norma and Gary. And Dean, it's early, but there has been a fair bit of presidential polling lately, especially by New England College, putting out a plethora of polls. Why bother now, so early, well, Dean, in the process?
Because people enjoy this stuff. It feeds the media beast. It's good public relations for New England College or any other institution that decides to put out these batches of polls. It gets attention. It gets you mentioned in national news. All institutions like to do this kind of stuff. You know, at this point, it really is kind of a measure of name recognition. You know, some of the different polls I've seen, not just New England College, but Public Policy Polling, University of New Hampshire. You know, on the Democratic side, they all show Hillary Clinton way out ahead of Joe Biden by upwards of 40 to 50 points. And on the Republican side, it's really a function of name recognition. So, you know, the leaders.
And there's lots of names.
Yeah, the leaders, but the people who are leading in the polls, like Chris Christie, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Rand Paul, they're all people who have had high visibility moments in the last 6 months to a year.
Bobby Jindal,
Bobby Jindal's only at about 2% in the polls, though, even though he was here. But, you know, Christie with Hurricane, you know, Sandy and sort of meeting with Obama, Marco Rubio and immigration and his speech at the Republican National Convention, Paul Ryan, a candidate for vice president, Rand Paul, the big filibuster. Recently in Congress.
He was in Iowa recently.
Yeah. So, and he's going to be here, actually, I believe, on Monday as well.
Oh, wow.
So you know, it's part of the dance. It's a lot of fun. It gets, it's something for people to write about. It's something for pollsters to do to keep themselves busy. But, you know, at this point, it really is just kind of a snapshot of name recognition and kind of conventional wisdom.
Too early to get on the dance floor, Gary?
Well, at this point, it's kind of, you know, insider baseball in a lot of ways. The only people who are really paying attention are the activists. But, I mean, no, it's never too early. I mean, the last few elections we've had, presidential elections, these people have been here right after the election, coming and trying to get their name out, trying to put people together and find activists that will help them. And so it's the way it's been the last couple presidential elections, really.
And in a more serious note, Gary, correct me if I'm wrong, it isn't just, you know, fun for the pollster group, fun for reporters, yeah, fun for politically active people to look at, but it really helps these people decide much support I might have, you know.
Who they can line up to help them, the inside, the activists who work on campaigns every 4 years.
Yeah.
And it is a good way of finding out whether you really are going to be on the stage or you're not going to be.
Yeah. Go ahead, Norma.
Think of it as an interview process. I mean, think about it. I mean, what's the old joke about New Hampshire? You have to meet the guy or the girl three times before you decide whether you're going to vote for them. Well, it's the same thing, I think, with the activists. And you need them if you're going to have an organization. And they will go and find you other people. And so you network out. It's just it's an interview process. You start out here because New Hampshire does have the first primary. It's still very important to have this as your launching pad. So, yeah, we were talking before about Lamar Alexander in 1996. They hadn't even declared a winner, and he was already campaigning. So he started 4 years early.
Yeah, I do remember that, actually, shortly after Bill Clinton won re-election, getting faxes. We didn't have email back then, we got a fax from Lamar Alexander minutes after Bill Clinton was declared the winner. So you're right. It does always start early.
You got to interview people. I mean, it's not just the polls. I think the polls, I agree with Dean, they're pretty meaningless at this point. I mean, we don't even know if Hillary Clinton's going to run.
Yeah.
And yet they're already running efforts to drive up her negatives over Benghazi. And you have the same thing happening. I think people might think Rubio and Ayotte are two of the rising stars, and you have groups running against Ayotte's vote on background checks.
Well, all of you, I want to close out with the question I always enjoy asking you at the end of these New Hampshire Friday News Roundups, and that's what stories you'll be especially watching next week. And Dean, how about you?
Yeah, interesting story just caught my attention. One of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was actually up here in Manchester a month before the bombing at a shooting range with a former Chechen rebel living in exile in Manchester. FBI searched the individual's home. Said he's not a target of investigation right now, but you know, we had that fireworks story a while back where one of the brothers or both had come up and bought some fireworks in New Hampshire, and now we see another connection with the meeting in Manchester. So, and I think Tsarnaev had actually been up here a couple times, I believe. So that's kind of an interesting story to watch both locally and nationally.
Yeah, and that was based on some reporting by the Voice of America, as picked up by the Union Leader.
Yep.
Right. Gary, how about you next week?
Oh, next week is going to be a fun week at the State House. Wednesday we have gambling, and Thursday we have the Senate taking up everything from medical marijuana to stand your ground.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It'll be a long day in the Senate.
Norma.
I think gambling, but also the Senate is going to start working on its budget. They're meeting, I heard, 9 to 9 or something like that. So you kind of have to have your finger in that, as well as gambling, as well as stand your ground, as well as medical marijuana. They're just running around everywhere.
All right. We'll have a lot to talk about next week for sure. Thank you all very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with the end of NECAPs. The standardized tests that Granite State students have long taken are being replaced by a whole new system. Then an energy plan for New Hampshire. With so many proposals on the table now, some say it's time to look at the big picture. And we close out the week with our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange. Every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
It's a minute shy of 10 o'clock. Just ahead, Diane Reeves Show on New Hampshire Public Radio, whose support comes from you, our members, and from the Grant Family State Motors.